Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 70 of the show where we talk about aviation. I'm Max Flight. Today we have a gaggle of geeks, including co-host Rob Bark. Hello, Rob.
What? So I'm part of a gaggle now?
You are this week.
Is that a promotion from last week?
I think it is.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, listen, welcome everybody. Glad you're there.
Dan is off again, doing what he should be doing. That's schoolwork.
Dan's doing his homework? Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay.
This episode, we're going to focus on the recent NBAA convention. And to do that, we've got some guests who are there, along with Rob. First is Randy Padfield, the editor-in-chief of Aviation International News. Thanks for joining us, Randy.
Hello, everybody. Nice to be here.
We also have Benay Wilson. She's the Aviation Week online managing editor for Business Aviation. Welcome back to the show, Benay.
Thank you, Max. Glad to be here.
And finally, also returning is John Ostrower, the flight blogger from Flight Global. Hi, John.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me tonight.
It's good to have you back. Okay, later we have this week's report from the Airplane Geeks Australia desk, which includes some fantastic radial engine and other airplane sounds. You're going to want to listen to that. And as always, we'll have David Vanderhoof with his This Week in Aviation. Courtney also has another Whiskey Tango Foxtrot segment that's actually on a listener-suggested topic. We've also got some mail to go through, and we have a call to our new listener line. So why don't we get started with highlights from the NBAA convention? Everybody ready?
I'm ready.
Yeah, let's go. Yeah, I'm ready.
Why don't we start off by helping some of our listeners who may not be familiar with the National Business Aviation Association and what that's all about. This is a organization of, I guess, maybe about 8,000 member companies that, according to the NBAA website, companies that rely on general aviation aircraft to help make their businesses more efficient, productive, and successful. And the event that occurred last week was their annual convention and meeting, which I think they bill as the world's largest civil aviation trade show. Rob, maybe you can start us off and kind of tell us why the NBAA is important to airplane geeks and you know, others in the industry.
Well, you know, I think that in my perspective, I think what we saw happen last fall when the folks from the big three automakers decided that their airplanes were no longer viable business machines because they didn't know how to handle the publicity. And you watch that sort of that domino effect of other airplane flight departments kind of falling apart. NBAA really jumped in and said, hey, guys, we have a great business tool here, and people are not going to stop using them just because three dodos did not know what to do when the media put a microphone in their face. And so, you know, one of NBAA's really large perspectives, I mean, one of their grand perspectives is their legislative efforts up on the Hill. And they do a great deal of publicity. There have been a great many pieces of outreach about business aviation and the importance of it. In fact, Ed Boland and I had a nice little chat there before our social media conference the other day talking about some of those outreach efforts. And I think they do, they're kind of that central focus for people who operate business airplanes, the pilots, the flight department managers, the schedulers, the dispatchers, and it's their central place to go for information to help them run more efficiently.
I would imagine that the current, you know, economic recession, which has obviously had a huge impact on the business aviation segment, I mean, that had to have been, a topic of conversation. Was it the background of, you know, the sort of the wallpaper that the convention sort of operated around, or was it the topic of discussion?
You mean the issue that went on in Detroit?
No, I mean just the issue of the economy.
Oh, I, you know, Randy or John or Benay might actually be even better to answer that than I, but I got the impression, certainly you could tell from from the numbers of people you saw walking the floors of the show, I mean that issue was on everybody's mind. John, I don't know, what do you
say? I totally agree with you, Rob. You know, every conversation began and ended with discussion about the economy. It really was the backdrop for the show. But I think in a lot of respects, that's the context in which you have to see business aviation right now. So business aviation a year ago got dealt what was essentially a double hit. You know, it's not only enough to have the perception issues driven by what happened with the big three automakers last November, but also the economy, which has beaten down corporate profits, which are the leading indicator for business aviation. And once you kind of move those two together, it really does, you know, set the stage for how you kind of look at business aviation and where we can kind of see a recovery off in the distance. You know, I think there was a good sense that I think when the industry comes together like this, that they come together, you know, almost as like kind of a sigh of relief that other people are still around and they're wanting to do business and they want to be involved and they want to be talking with other people. So I think that's, you know, it's always good for a nice shot in the arm for the industry. But absolutely the economy was the centerpiece of the show.
I think also a big question that everyone had, I mean, we had the Honeywell forecast and the Bombardier forecast and the Embraer forecast. And I think everybody just wants to know when we're going to get out of it. And the different forecasts had different numbers on how long we're going to be in. Some people say we're still bumping along. Some say we're going down again and we won't start seeing some recovery until 2011, 2012. I think that was also a big question that everyone was talking about.
I would agree with what everyone else has said, and also like to point out that there have been a lot of jobs lost in the industry itself,
sure.
Both on the manufacturing side and also, you know, some flight departments closing, charter operators having to let people go because they're not flying as much. So, yeah, the economy was a big factor. But that said, I think there was a general viewpoint that, you know, you were either a glasses half full person or you were a glasses half empty person. And, you know, the optimists were saying, well, we've reached the bottom, it's going to get better. And the more pessimist or maybe realistic ones are saying, yeah, well, the glass is half empty, but it may get worse for a little bit before it gets better.
I was reading the report from the opening session where Rich Karlgaard, I guess he's the publisher of Forbes magazine, spoke. And he was pointing out that in times like this, you get to discover who the weak parties are, and I guess they fall off, and who the creative and innovative companies are that can take advantage of a situation like this. I love the quote that I read from him, which was, when we have these recessions and the tide drops, we find out who's been swimming with no clothes.
Yeah, that's interesting. Another one that we picked up is one person said there weren't as many tire kickers coming around on the exhibit hall floor and at the static display as there have been in the past. And in fact, the attendance was down almost one-third. It was 22,000-something this year, where it was 32,000 and change last year, which was also down from the year before.
Right.
So there were fewer people. On the other hand, I heard Ed Boland say that 95% of the flight departments that had been at the convention last year were represented, but obviously there were fewer people probably from the various departments and also from the exhibitors themselves.
And you could see that on the showroom floor. I had a chance to walk across it several times. And, I mean, the last NBAA I was at was probably, I think I want to say it was 2000 or 2001. And I remember, you know, it was very crowded and very enthusiastic. But here, there were just these wide open swatches of space. And then you had people like Cessna and Hawker Beechcraft who didn't even exhibit in the show hall. They were just out at the static display.
Hmm. Yeah, I think another telling factor was at the media breakfast, and this was repeated at the opening general session, which takes place on the first official day of the show. Ed Boland and Pete Bunce from the General Aviation Manufacturers Association. I mean, usually there's, you know, a lot of, you know, optimism about what things are happening, but this time they were really talking about the effects of the automakers last year, the effects of the downturn of the economy, and what their program to kind of improve the viewpoint that the general public have about business aviation, and it's called No Plane, No Gain, and you know, showing a video that Arnold Palmer, the golfer, just made in support of business aviation, and it was very much almost like an in the trenches. Look, we're fighting this effort to improve the viewpoint of business aviation, even while sales and deliveries are down and people have been laid off.
It's kind of like managing the perception of business aviation, right? That's sort of the task that maybe we fell down on a little bit.
Well, yeah, it might have, that was mentioned, I think, at the media breakfast. But you know, when everything's going up, you know, and the backlogs are with the OEMs, the original equipment manufacturers, airplane manufacturers, are building so much that they can't keep up with them, and you have to wait 2, 3, 4, 5 years for an airplane that you know, a customer wants tomorrow because they just can't build them fast enough. Well, that's a nice problem to have, and you know, you don't worry so much about, you know, what the perception is in the marketplace, because everybody's buying and operating. But when sales start going down and you have to start laying people off and the backlogs are shrinking, and you get all this negative information, right, from Congress and other places, then you know, you start addressing that problem or those problems.
John, did you see signs? Go ahead.
That's actually a good point. No, I think that really touched on something important. And maybe it's not the most popular viewpoint, but I think if we take a really, you know, hard appraisal at business aviation over the years, BizAv has always had a perception problem. It just, what happened was the perception problem then infected business aviation. You know, the outside public has always viewed business aviation as extravagant, as unnecessary. And then once you combine that with what was essentially the intersection of the bailout of business aviation and the recession and all the automakers around that, I think that everything that was kind of on the outside kind of got pulled in. You know, it's almost like the hard shell was cracked, and that the core of the solo business aviation was really, really, really threatened in that respect.
Right.
But I also think that, I mean, I started writing about business aviation at the beginning of December. I don't know if that's great timing for me or bad or what, but it seemed like, to me, looking, just coming into the industry, you know, this thing happened with the auto executives in mid-November, and I was waiting for people to come out and say something. And, you know, the associations did, but that's what they're supposed to do. But, you know, it took, I mean, until February, from what I saw, for people to come right out and really start defending it. Now, I understand that people were in a tight position, like when Starbucks, you know, they had to get that new Gulfstream, you know, they were replacing two older aircraft, but they just happened to also freeze the match on their 401k and shut down a bunch of stores. And they got a lot of slack from that, especially from the Seattle area media. And so they just backed off and said, we're selling it, it's done. Right. You know,
well, you know, the whole economic thing just hit like a tsunami. And I was talking to one guy at Compair who's trying to get financing to continue building his prototypes, and he had money that was invested through Lehman Brothers. And the money, just week before Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, the money was put in the bank for like $500,000 or something like that, you know, so we could continue the research and development. And it was in an escrow account. And, you know, a week later, Lehman Brothers went bankrupt and that money was gone because everything was frozen. And then a little while later on in the year, he was with another bank that was, you know, really energetically promising him some money. And that bank was a a lending organization that got turned over to a bank, and they couldn't do venture capital funding anymore. So yeah. It's like a series of problems for them. And I think that's, you multiply those kind of things throughout, numerous companies and people who are buying airplanes that were walking. Some people have said they've walked away from $1 million deposits because they just couldn't get financing to pay for the rest of their airplane. And it just snowballs, across the industry like that.
How about signs of optimism? Did we see any announcements or behavior from any companies that show us that, maybe things are heading in a positive direction?
I think Embraer's announcement about the 650, the Legacy 650, which is their official entrant into the large cabin category of aircraft. This was an extended range version of what they call the super midsize version of the Legacy 600. It's more or less the exact same cabin. Few key changes in the airframe, but really you get a coast to coast range and a cabin to match. That was the first real sign, I thought, that really from a new aircraft point of view, that the industry is really going to be pushing its way through this. But I think it is telling that Embraer's assumptions really come down to the fact that they assume that the recovery will be led by outside of the United States, that it's going to be led in emerging markets like India and China and Russia and Brazil, for that matter, and that U.S. manufacturers are in obviously a very difficult situation because if the rest of the U.S. economy isn't coming back as fast as they'd like, obviously then the markets that they have traditionally been bound to and ridden the highs and lows with might not be there. And that creates a very different dynamic. But I think what we see is the shifting center of gravity of the business aviation world.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And then you also have Gulfstream with its G250 and G650, which they both rolled out within just 2 or 3 weeks before the convention. And both of those airplanes are supposed to make the first flights before the end of the year. So Gulfstream, General Dynamics, which is General Dynamics owns Gulfstream, and they're committed to getting those airplanes flying and certified and in production. And also, I think it was ARG US, which tracks flight activity, has said that general flight activity has leveled out and has actually increased a little bit among business aircraft users, mainly flight departments, although charter remains to be a little bit down.
I saw a report in AOPA online that indicates that Piper Aircraft is looking to increase their production by 50% next year, which is that's a lot of growth, I guess.
Well, Max, if I could add something to that too, I mean, something that was a significant but soon to be growing part of the NBA convention this year was the light business aircraft aspect of this, which it was intended to be a separate show. Last, Randy Benet, you'll have to help me. I think it was going to be last March or April or something out in San Diego, and then NBA canceled it. So they tried to combine some aspects of operating light business aircraft into this event, aircraft down as small as perhaps the Cirrus SR-22. And I had a chance to attend one of the sessions that John and Martha King ran on owning and operating your own jet. For people that had never operated a jet before. And the room was packed.
Oh, really?
It was
That's
just
interesting.
Packed. And of course, John and Martha are always the for the listeners that may not know them, the premier husband and wife CFI team in the world, probably. But they are just a stitch to watch on stage. And but again, they really went into the depths of not only what it costs to operate their jet, but how they got there and sort of the things that they stumbled on over along the way. And I can't tell you how many of the people in the audience were asking very, very basic questions, which made it clear that there were people that were in Cirruses and Bonanzas and Barons and things like that that were thinking of moving up. So I guess I took that as somewhat of a positive indication as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
I also had the chance to spend the afternoon down at the static display and had the chance to kind of sit and chat with some of the brokers. And talking to them, you know, I actually kind of sat in and on one of the aircraft where people were coming in and looking and asking about prices and everything. And one broker that I spoke to in particular, he said, you know, they've had a lot of activity, especially in the past 2 or 3 months as the credit markets are slowly starting to unfreeze. But, of course, most of them were not U.S. buyers. They were from other countries.
HondaJet made some announcements. I don't know what their presence was like there. I don't know if they had a display or any kind of, you know, static exhibit. But any reaction from folks on the HondaJet?
Well, I actually had a chance to speak with the CEO of Honda Aircraft,
Nichi Masa Fujino,
who is the CEO of Honda Aircraft. Thank you very much for that, Randy. I couldn't pronounce that. In fact, when I met him, I told him I was probably not going to be able to pronounce his name. But you know, I said, well, so what's the real story with the HondaJet? And of course, they took a delay of a year because they ran into some significant parts supplier problems. Pretty much what most of the aircraft makers in the U.S. and other parts of the world had experienced. But he did tell me that they felt as if they were back on track now. But when one of the stories that I actually ended up writing, which I thought was really kind of neat that he mentioned, was the difference, the cultural differences between how the Japanese view how things should be built and how Americans thought things should be built.
Yeah,
and it was just very interesting, I think, to hear his take on it. But that I'll save that for another time. But in general, they think they'll have the airplanes in the delivery mode by sometime mid to late 2011.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I mean, they have some hours on a development plane, and I think they're saying first flight of a conforming aircraft early next year, early in 2010. And another interesting thing is where that's going to be manufactured, which I guess is in their Greensboro, North Carolina facility.
Correct. Most of it is. I think there's some in a plant. Isn't there a plant down in Alabama, I think, that's doing some of it as well? Maybe I'm wrong there. But
didn't they do a deal with FedEx to provide the sort of the logistics for bringing the components to?
Absolutely. And one thing I can tell you that I did see that was really interesting, of course, you know, listeners may know that, you know, one of the primary platforms for the Garmin G1000 when it first was being developed in early 2000 was the HondaJet. And so it was actually the first aircraft to show up with the Garmin in it. And, of course, it was the first, other than Garmin themselves, the Honda people had a great display of the new G3000 system, which is basically a touchscreen version of the Garmin 1000. And I had a chance to play with that, and it was pretty cool.
Pretty slick, huh?
Well, it's like an iPhone. John would understand this. It's like an iPhone for the Garmin. So.
Well, and that was introduced at the show, the G3000
Correct.
From Garmin.
Yeah,
that was one of the big announcements, and that's positive too. I think that, you know, there were a number of avionics announcements that were made, you know, new things and also retrofits, and you know, people getting equipped. Flight Options has said that they're going to equip their whole or a good part of their fleet with AirCell high speed internet, and you know, Flight Display has got this retrofit their cabin management system, and Nextent, which is a retrofit of Learjets, has got the STC for their Rockwell Collins ProLine 21 avionics. So, even though there weren't, you know, really big OEM announcements, there's a lot of other supplier and avionics and parts manufacturers type announcements that were being made almost, you know, continually at the show.
Now, there was some kind of a panel discussion or event that many of you guys participated in. am I correct in that?
Oh, man. Hey, listen, we had some fun. We had a social media panel discussion that NBAA sponsored for us on the last day of the show. And let's see, our panelists were, I moderated it, and I had B'nai Wilson, I had Ryan Keough from Qatar Aviation, Patrick Dunn from NBAA, and we had John Ostrower planted in the audience. And he did a really... He did a really marvelous job of pretending as if he wasn't really expecting to be in the show.
Yeah, he did. He did actually do a great job. And one of the interesting things about that is, as we were in the panel, John created a hashtag. And for those of you who don't know what a hashtag is, it's kind of you put the pound sign in front of a topic, and so you can follow that topic. So any of you who are interested on Twitter, and if you're interested in continuing, we're continuing the conversation. The hashtag is NB. It's pound sign NBAA. S is in Sam, M is in Mary. And we're continuing the conversation. I mean, we had a packed room, and people had lots of questions.
And so,
it was a fantastic discussion. It really was. I mean, you know, Rob's up there like, you know, Jay Leno or Johnny Carson, you know.
I was in my element. I was having such a good time. Yeah. But as we let me just one thing though that I thought was funny is that I took all the easy questions from, you know, with walking around with the microphone, and then whenever the stuff got really hard, I'd say, "Well, but hey, what do you think about that?" Or Ryan, that sounds like your baby. Or John, what do you think? And then they all made me look really good.
So, what was the thrust of the discussion?
I think that people were just they wanted to know what was going on. They know that people are out there doing it. And, you know, we in aviation,
social
we tend
media.
To...
Let's be sure. I want to be clear about that.
Yes. I think people like... In aviation, we like directions. We like handbooks. We like manuals that lay out everything to tell us what we're supposed to do. And social media is not that. Everybody has to adjust it to their own tastes and preferences. And I think people were there just to kind of get a sense, okay, how do we get started with this? What do we do? What tools should we use? What are we doing this for? How does it help our business?
So do you think as a result, many of these people are going to go out and try to explore social media as it applies to their business activities? I mean, did you get that sense? Or are the people still kind of trying to come to grips with it?
I hope so.
I think a little of both.
Okay.
Yeah, I got to say, I'm a very unsocial networker. I mean, I have Twitter, I have Facebook, I have LinkedIn, and I hardly ever even look at them. And when I first started doing Twitter, I got so many hits from Binet that I thought, I can't watch these. I can't even keep up with my email. So nothing personal, Binet, but they were just tweets or whatever they're called, one after another. So why should I pay attention to these?
Well, let me tell you.
Did I say something wrong?
No, Binet has an answer for
you. No, not at all. You know, Randy, it's just one tool that I use, and it does look like I'm on there all the time, but I have tools that allow me to time my tweets. I mean, because I actually do have a job. I have a newsletter to write. I have blog posts to do. I have our Aviation Week Intelligence Network to handle and, you know, dealing with all of our correspondents. So to me, it's just part of the whole package, a tool. It's also been great for me because I've got to meet a lot of people online that have become story sources. I've gotten some really good story ideas, and I've actually met some great people like Max.
Yeah, sure.
And again, what I said in the panel, it's a tool, and it's how you want to use it. I mean, some people do 1, 2, maybe 3 tweets a day, and that's it. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. I'm just a very social person, and I like to be in the conversation. But it's really, again, it's up to you.
Well, I can understand, you know, doing 1 or 2 or 3 tweets a day, but it's just the volume that comes in, though. What do you do with that?
Well, that's why we were talking about this. There are tools. And, Randy, I'll talk to you offline because I actually have this guide that I have been passing out like candy because I had to learn this stuff myself. So I know that we're competitors, but John will tell you and Rob will tell you. I will help anyone who's trying to navigate this because, in the end, it helps all of us. It helps the industry. It helps the craft of journalism. And I have a guide that will help you get through this. But the end, we're just trying to reach out to our audiences more, enhance our stories, and just, you know, make our product better.
Okay. Sounds great. Thank you.
And you know,
I think that was like the one big takeaway that we had, actually, that it was, you know, I mentioned an interaction that I had earlier, a previous week at a conference in Las Vegas, that was actually specifically devoted to new media and blogging. And really, it came down to the fact that everyone in the room who was there understood social media, understood how it worked, understood how it could be used as a tool for whether it's journalism, for business enterprises, whatever. But that, you know, go ahead and give yourselves a pat on the back. Now that you know how to use it, you have a responsibility to show other people how to use it. It's, you know, it's not just the thing that the cool kids do anymore. And you know, keeping it to yourself is not an option. Because if you can't just roll your eyes, you know, you have to now take what you've learned and make sure other people understand it. Because ultimately, I mean, from our perspective as journalists, I think that in a situation where we're seeing what essentially an existential crisis for journalism, you know, how we use these new tools to keep print media alive and evolving to the latest technology, I think is something that really benefits all of us as journalists.
Exactly.
Now, how would a professional pilot or a business aviation pilot or a flight department benefit from using Twitter?
I really wish that Ryan was on this call because he actually spoke to this on the panel. But, you know, the pilots and the flight department, you know, the pilots are always going everywhere. And Ryan said that they actually use it as another form of communication. And it's also a way to get like-minded people together because you can whittle down your networks to have just a key group of people that you talk to. And the flight departments talk to each other and the pilots are talking to each other. And to Ryan said, it's just another way to communicate with the people that are out there. And if there's an issue, you know, Qatar follows their Twitter feed and somebody says something like, well, where's the fueler at whatever station? So they see that and they can immediately go and get to that. I mean, that's just one of the examples that he used.
Yeah, it's really about enlarging the conversation, you know, pulling more people into the conversation and the discussion. But it is true. At times it can be kind of a bit like a fire hose. So you know, there are ways that you can kind of help to manage that to varying degrees, but in the end, I think in some ways you just have to approach it differently than you approach other forms of communication. It's not like email. It's not like, you know, composing a well thought out blog post or you know an article in a magazine, for example. It oftentimes has to be, you know, much more concise and to the point, and it's just a different way of thinking about it, I think.
Well, and one thing I would add too is that social media is still very much in the early stages of evolving.
Yeah.
And I don't think, honestly, Randy, that everybody knows exactly where all the pieces fit. But I mean, if you go back, I remember when I was in graduate school 20 years ago and people said, email. So wait, people are going to be sending me messages and this is going to be in addition to my voicemail? Why in the Sam Hill would I want to do that? And everyone thought it was stupid. Now, I'm not saying that 2 years from now we might not be saying, boy, that whole Twitter thing just kind of fell apart, didn't it? Because we very well may. But what I do think is revolutionary is that people do not gather information the same way that they used to. You know, large organizations are no longer the gatekeepers of the information in which they decide what people will hear, when they'll hear it, and how they'll hear it. People decide for themselves. And if a particular media outlet or a company does not fit the delivery system that some of these young folks and even some of us old guys want, we just go around them. And we say, you know what? I don't need them. I'll go someplace else and get the information.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's one of the things that everybody's going to have to cope with.
Okay, maybe we can start to wrap it up a little bit. And maybe I'll ask each of you, starting with John, perhaps, for any key takeaways or observations from the convention that we haven't talked about that left an impression with you. John, anything stand out in your mind that we haven't talked about?
People need to stop beating up on Wichita, Kansas. You know, I think the Wichita Eagle had a very interesting editorial today where it actually called out another aviation publication's coverage about asking the question whether or not Wichita would become the next Detroit. Mm-hmm. And they took great offense at that. And I wrote a 3,000-word feature in the lead up to NBAA on Wichita. And I was out there for several days in early September. And I very intentionally took a very different track with the piece. The easiest piece in the world to write was the, you know, things are bad and here's how many people have been laid off. And those details were, of course, in the story. But I wanted to focus on how these companies are surviving, kind of what's changed internally and what has that done to the mindset of the people who have stayed. And I think that we often forget that there is a very, very, very large and thriving aviation industry there. Planes are still coming out of there. And that the people who remain ultimately are going to be essentially the the overseers of the companies until the production picks up again.
Right.
And these people return. They are the stewards of the companies. And that was really kind of the theme that ran throughout the people I spoke to, that things are bad, but they've been bad before and they get good again. And I think that to write off Wichita as a manufacturing center for aerospace would be a little too soon to write that obituary.
Okay, good. Binet, anything comes to your mind?
Yes, I think it's fascinating. We're talking about all of this perception of the industry, and NBAA gave away two awards to journalists. One, the Platinum Award for Lifetime Achievement, was my boss, Bill Garvey. In that piece, he was cited, Ed Bolin cited, among other things, Bill Garvey's piece that appeared, op-ed piece that appeared in the New York Times on Super Bowl Sunday, defending business aviation, and kind of seen as a marker on when the tide kind of started turning. I'm not saying that, you know, the negative perception isn't there, but it was the first time there was an actual defense and people were like, oh, let's listen to this. And then, which segues perfectly to your esteemed co-host, Rob Mark, who won the Gold Award for his editorial in Business Jet Traveler about defending your business jet.
And I think I would add, just I don't mean to jump in here, but that's actually his second award for that piece.
Yes, that's right. He won an Aerospace Journalist of the Year award for that piece also. But I think that it's interesting that it was these two publications that came out and kind of led the way in a way to kind of stem the tide of all this continued, it was just this continued negative battering of the industry. And it just kind of shows the role and the line that we walk as independent trade journalists, but also as almost, I mean, advocates for the industry
right.
that we write about.
Gee, congratulations, Rob.
Thank you very much. It was really, I tell you, I have to just mention this story, and Binet and John and all, thank you so much for mentioning it. But I was down there for a few days working for Randy because they were so busy. They decided that it would look really good if they had an old guy in there looking like he was working as hard as Randy was. And so I think that's why you brought me in, wasn't it, Randy?
Well, they got the old part right.
Yeah, they got the old part. But seriously,
well,
I mean,
cheap. That's right.
Yeah, well, that's true. But you know, I think what was really interesting is they tricked me. I mean, they said, Rob, we need you there at the breakfast at 7 o'clock in the morning to cover the breakfast for the magazine. And I thought, well, all right, I'm on Randy's payroll. I mean, if he and Matt say I've got to be there, that's what I've got to do. So I get to the table, and there are all these people from Business Jet Traveler and AIN and everybody else sitting at the table. And I said, well, if you're all here, what did I need to be here for? I mean, couldn't one of you have covered this and I could have slept in or something? And it's really funny because I did honestly have no idea they were going to do that. And they really caught me napping. And Matt Thurber, the show editor that day, caught some pictures of me writing notes. And then they mentioned my name. And I have this deer in the headlights look on my face. And it was really
That's
nice.
Cool.
It really was. But of course, too, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that it's the point of the article was that the people in Detroit sort of opened the floodgates of this problem, not by not just by denying their airplanes, but what they could have said was, hey, yeah, we used our airplanes to get here. And you know what? We came here in these airplanes because they save us a lot of time. They save us a lot of money. We've had a flight department for 50 years, and we're going to keep using a flight department because it helps us be more competitive. That's what people would have liked them to say, and unfortunately, they didn't do that.
Do you think they had any idea of the consequences of the approach they ended up taking?
Oh, I don't. You know what? I'm sure at the time it happened,
it
didn't even cross their minds that it would ever blow up in their faces. I don't know. Do you think, Binet?
Well, that's interesting because Bill Garvey, on the last day of our show issue, did an interview with Ken Emmerich, who was the manager of GM's flight department. And he basically said, you know, we just had no clue until right after it happened, and we, you know, you could almost sense the change. And yeah, then it just all hit. And what was interesting about that is, you know, GM has suppliers all over the world, and I remember listening to an NPR interview with Bob. Oh, I'm trying to remember his Bob, the vice chairman who's overseeing the Volt. And at the end, there was a throwaway question about, well, do you miss the GM business jet fleet? And he was like, yes, I hate this. I hate standing in line at the Northwest ticket counter with the rest of the people. This is really a pain in the behind, you know, so.
And you know, what I think was a problem, too, is that some of the way that they – some of the tack that they took made it sound like the sentence that was not in there was, yeah, I hate all the time we're wasting doing this. I hate being in line with, in parentheses, the riffraff. That's
yes.
The way people took it. And I don't think that's what they meant at all, but that's the way people took it.
Okay, Randy, any kind of closing thoughts on the – on the convention?
Yeah, just to, first of all, probably one of the best kept secrets in aviation trade journalism is that Rob Mark is completely illiterate.
Okay. Am I glad we had this guy on?
No, his okay. head shrunk back to the normal.
Let's see where
apparently
he's going.
Apparently, you know, he dictates everything to his wife, and she writes it. And,
yeah.
And he also has very good editors, you know, at the magazine. I know because I was one of them.
well, that's important.
But we were very, very – no, seriously, we're very, very happy that Rob was able to get that award. And also happy that Bill Garvey, who's a close friend too, was given the Platinum Wing Award. The other thing is I see an increasing importance at NBAA of the static display area as opposed to the exhibit hall. And the exhibit hall, I think, is going to be – maintain get a lot of people for mainly suppliers and engine companies and things like that. But I think you know, with Cessna and Hawker Beechcraft deciding this year not to put up exhibits in the exhibit hall and to focus their presence at NBAA at the static display airport instead. And then, of course, Bombardier and Gulfstream and a lot of other aircraft manufacturers and people with airplanes for sale were at the static display area. And it was, in my mind, it was really hopping. I think that's going to be one place that will be attracting a lot more people in the future.
Interesting.
You know, can I just throw something in that, you know, Randy or John or Binet, you jump in here too, but I guess if I were NBAA, I would be very worried about just what Randy mentioned, that some companies, large companies, let's face it, Cessna had one of the largest booths at the show, normally 100 by 100. That's a pretty good size. I would be worried that too many companies might say, you know what, we don't really need to be in the show hall. Let's just be out at the static display. And that, you know, that will decrease traffic in the show area even more. I don't know. It's just something I wondered about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and NBA has, you know, they have ways to make you put up an exhibit. For example, you can't have a press conference unless you have an exhibit. So, and, you know, they could revise their rules, you know, for having a static display aircraft. They might say, well, you have to have an exhibit too. But that said, the the manufacturers are associate members of the NBAA, so they'll have a say in this too.
All right. Well, very good. I just have one more question. It's totally off topic, but because John's with us, I can't resist. John, what's your prediction for the next first flight of the 787?
No, no, please don't do it. Don't do it.
I still stand by my original prediction, which was June 26, 2009.
That was your prediction.
Yes. I'm still waiting. Wait.
How's that working out for you, John?
I'm told that it's late October.
Late October.
Oh, it is late October. I don't know.
2009, you mean?
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, I honest to God, I've decided to stop trying to predict this.
So is Boeing.
No, I wish they would. It pains me every time I see them say something. I just say, please, just be quiet. Say nothing.
Yeah, say it'll fly when it flies.
Yeah, but that makes us crazy.
It does.
Well,
it
I know,
does.
But what they tell us makes us crazy too.
So you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
I think that's the way it goes. It's kind of like being a parent.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank our guests this episode. Thanks to Binay Wilson from Aviation Week, John Ostrower from Flight Global, the Flight Blogger, and Randy Padfield from Aviation International News. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having
us. Nice having you all here.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian with This Week in Aviation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to first of all congratulate Rob Mark for his outstanding award at NBAA.
Oh, thank you very much. That was so nice of you to do that.
And when's my autograph book coming?
Soon. It's in the mail with the check.
With the briefcase.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 1, Episode 19, October 25th through October 31st. October 25th, 1930. Transcontinental and Western Air, the airline that becomes Transworld Airways, begins the first regular passenger flights between New York and Los Angeles, the Lindbergh route. It was the first all-plane service. Originally, TAT, Transcontinental Air Transport, had coast-to-coast service. However, the passengers flew during the day and took a Pullman sleeper during the overnights.
Wow.
The Lindbergh route took 36 hours to complete and had an overnight in Kansas City, Missouri. The service used Ford trimotors.
Those are amazing.
Beautiful airplane.
Isn't there at least one that you can take rides on?
There's a trimotor that lives out at EAA out in Oshkosh that they give you rides in.
Yeah.
I don't know if, is that a Ford? I think that's a Fokker, maybe.
Is it a Fokker?
I might be wrong. I should know better than to argue with you about that stuff because I always get the facts wrong. So I'm just, if David says it's a Ford, it's a Ford.
Okay.
And if anybody wants to correct us, please do. On October 25th, 1951, Japan Airlines, JAL, begins domestic service in Japan. Initially, the service is flown by Northwest Airlines Martin 202 Northwest NWs, and they were flown with Northwest crews. October 26th, 1958, Pan American World Airways inaugurates transatlantic service by jet. Clipper America, a Boeing 707-121, November 7-11 PA, flies from New York JFK to JFK Worldport to Paris, France, Le Bourget. It was Pan Am that had Boeing change the interior from 5 seats across to 6 feet across. As far as I can tell, the seat pitch was 34 inches in coach and 40 inches in first class.
Huh.
That was for Dan.
Yeah.
On the 25th anniversary of the flight, on 10-26-1983, Pan Am recreated the flight with a 707-321 freighter, November 880 PA. Comprehensive history of this flight and the restoration of the freighter to an airliner can be found in Airways Classics No. 1. On October 27, 1954, Benjamin Oliver Davis Jr. becomes the first black general in the United States Air Force. General Davis was a graduate of the University of Chicago, then attended the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Davis was part of Class 1 of the Tuskegee Air School. and Davis retired as a four-star general.
Hmm. Yay!
I remember him. Yeah, seriously, I remember him when I was in the Air Force.
He had an amazing career that I could write a couple of weeks' worth of stuff on. He commanded a fighter wing in Korea, F-86s, flew P-51s as a Tuskegee Airman in World War II. A very comprehensive and illustrious career.
Hmm. Cool.
October 30th, 1977, Pan Am 747 SP, Clipper Lindbergh, November 536 PA, lands after the polar flight around the Earth in a record 54 hours, 7 minutes. Pan Am Flight 50, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Pan Am, it flew from October 28th to October 30th, 1977, from San Francisco, and it had 3 stopovers at London Heathrow Airport, Cape Town International Airport, and Auckland Airport. Flight 50 flew both over the North Pole and South Pole. So it went, instead of going around, it went up and over and back.
Wow.
November 536 PA now flies for NASA and is now SOFIA, which stands for the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy. October 31st, 1956, the first American to land an airplane at the South Pole. Rear Admiral G.J. Dufek of the United States Navy lands the R-4D Skytrain Que Sera Sera. Que Sera Sera can be seen at the National Museum of Naval Aviation in Pensacola. Que Sera Sera lost her wing during Hurricane Hugo, and there's an organization trying to restore it, and the website is www.SaveQueSeraSera.org.
And we'll put that in the show notes.
First flights that occurred during the week of October 25th through October 31st. October 30th, 1938. The MAR-5 Sun was first observed flying in Grover's Mill. The pilot in command was O. Wells. The MAR-5 Sun was manufactured by Mercury and CBS. Only one flight was ever made. It was based on a study done by an obscure Englishman, H.G. Wells, who was no relations to the pilot. Wells' study was called Project Tripod. It was so successful on the air that the pilot, Wells, was stunned and immediately lost control. He apologized for the air show 2 days later. Wells went off to have a moderately successful career in film. H.G. Wells retired and went to a small tropical island called Moreau and was in a doctor's care there. In all, happy all Halloween, folks.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was, October 25th through October 31st. This is David M. Vanderhoof, the Airplane Geeks historian.
Great. Thanks, David.
Nice job, David.
Hey, I've got a little historical note of my own. I just wanted to mention, I don't think we, did we mention in the past that Richard Whitcomb passed away October 13th? This is the guy who developed the area rule and the now classic Coke bottle fuselage shape that allowed really practical supersonic aircraft to be developed.
Yeah, I did see that.
Yeah, he also invented the supercritical wing that's used on, certainly on most commercial airliners. And I also understand that he's the guy that developed the winglet. Apparently quite a guy, and passed away this past October 13th. So I thought I would just mention that.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Well, g'day folks, it's Steve Vischer here and I'm with Grant. How are you, mate?
Hey, not too bad, man. Not too bad. I'm really happy, mate. I'm out surrounded by aircraft at the moment.
Beautiful, mate. And we're standing here at Moorabbin Airport in Melbourne, Victoria. And we're down here to participate in the celebrations of the 75th anniversary of the McRobertson Air Race.
Yes, the MacArthur-Robertson Air Race, 1934, from London to Melbourne. That was one line honours taken by de Havilland 88 Comet, two-place custom-made racing aircraft, but was one on handicap by a Douglas DC-2 from KLM, known as the Iver. And we've been doing a lot of mucking around. Yeah, well, you would say it correctly. And right now we're standing at the museum and we're right beside a Australian CA-27, which probably only David Vanderhoof knows.
Yep, only David would know that, Dave.
That's it. He would know that that's a Australian-built F-86 Sabre, and it's a beautiful-looking aircraft. Shame it's not flying. I'd love to have a flying one of these.
Absolutely.
But, hang on.
Listen to that.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Sorry, folks, that was a P-40 flying overhead.
What were we talking about again, Mike?
Just trying to get it back together and... Oh, hang on.
Oh, boy.
That was pretty noisy, wasn't it?
That's, hey, sensational.
That's a Harvard. You guys call him a T6. That's a Harvard, the old trainer with the prop that goes supersonic. And, oh, wait a minute.
Boy,
I love radials. That was a Lockheed 12. Sorry, guys. We just had a bit of a flyby going on. And
what were we talking about again, Grant?
We're going to tell them some news. We've got some good bits of news to tell. Oh, hang on.
That sounds like a B-25.
Sorry, guys, that was the DC-3 starting up, man. There we go. Both engines are now started. We're flying on the DC-3. We'll pause it here, and we'll get back to you once we're inside the aircraft.
Cool? Yeah, if we can remember what we're talking about, we may be a little distracted, but we'll see how we go.
Yeah, we'll try and give you one inside.
We'll require run-up, so it'll take us, 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's much up whenever you're ready.
Up we go, Sarah. Thank you.
Anything, Lena?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard Horden, the DC-3 which operated the first flight for Trans-Australia Airlines on the 9th of September 1946. In preparation for departure, I'll be nominating the safety features of the aircraft and ask that you give me your complete attention. Should an evacuation of the aircraft be necessary, you should be familiar with the escape routes on this aircraft. There are 6 emergency exits.
Oh, listen to that sound, Grant.
Yeah, we've traded propellers for jets. That looks to me like a 777 going out. That's a Thai Airways 777 heading out at the moment.
Beautiful. So here we are at the Qantas maintenance base. We've finished our trip on the Horden, the DC-3, the one I keep confusing with the Ansett one. So if you ever hear me say that, like perhaps on the video I just shot, it's not the Ansett one, it's the TAA one. So we've had our flight, a remarkably smooth flight. It was fantastic. I've never been on a DC-3 before, mate, and we'll head back to the studio and finish this report.
Yeah, we were going to record the report on the aircraft, but we got the option to record the cockpit instead, and we figured that trumped. So
we thought you'd appreciate that, Rob.
So, thanks to the miracle of modern technology, we're going to pause here, and when we restart, we'll be back in the studio.
Oh, magic technology, and here we are, Grant, back in the Plane Crazy Down Under production facility.
Oh, are you sure about that? I always wonder about those transporters. Am I really me? I think I am.
Actually, I think this is your left hand. Anyway.
Oh, hey, give that back.
Okay, so a couple of quick stories that are making news down under this week. And the first one we're talking about here is a nose wheel disintegration on a Virgin Blue plane in Melbourne this week.
That's correct. You may remember a few months ago we reported on how a Virgin Blue 737NG was taking off and the nose wheel disconnected itself and kept trundling along the runway while the aircraft climbed out. That was put down to a corroded axle on the front wheel. Yeah, one of the wheels went trundling along. Well, now the latest, just recently, is that on landing, a nose wheel actually disintegrated and the whole thing spun off. So fortunately, a 737 has 2 wheels on its nose gear. But apparently the pilots felt the aircraft pulling off to one side and had to put in a lot of thrust and brakes to keep it aligned and noticed it was pulling on the way to the gate. It wasn't until they got to the gate that they found that it only had one nose wheel.
Yep, and now this is all good fodder for the Australian Licensed Aircraft Engineers Association. Their spokesman, Steve Pervinus, has been very vocal in the media lately, and there's obviously a bit of a campaign going on here at the moment regarding engineers and conditions at Virgin Blue. He's been quite vocal in the media lately. He's quoted here in an article that we got off AAP saying, it's fortunate that today's incident did not result in any serious injury, but it demonstrates the urgent need for safety inspections across all Virgin's planes. So, another thing I was thinking there too, Grant, was that that's really going to fall right into the hands of Qantas, who have not had the best press of late when it comes to maintenance issues. They'd be quite happy that the focus is perhaps shifting away from them just for a change.
Yeah, well, what Virgin Blue is doing is they're actually using non-licensed engineers to do a quick check. They've changed it from a certified check. They're now just doing a quick start of the day check, and they've pushed their weekly checks out to every 15 days. And this is all with the blessing of CASA, the Civil Aviation Safety Authority. Virgin Blue are going head-to-head with the union because, of course, if they do this, they don't need as many unionized engineers. If you follow the money, as with anything that goes on, you can see the union is talking safety, but they may also have an undercurrent of membership and dues. And Virgin Blue is talking, oh, we don't need all this kind of stuff. But again, they're talking an undercurrent of saving money. And of course, the phrase a low-cost carrier does not have to be a low-cost maintenance operation as well. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this one plays out.
These are the very sorts of issues that were raised when deregulation came to this country with regard to maintenance standards. And, you know, the catch cry back then, I remember, was, well, you know, what's going to happen? The standards are going to drop. We can't let this become the case. That's my opinion.
Yeah, no, definitely. You've got to maintain standards, both of customer service and of maintenance, no matter how much of a budget, low-cost airline you become.
Yep. So we'll leave that issue there. And just one more quick one, and this might interest you, Dan, with regard to numbers and everything else. We're just going to speculate here and say that Air Pacific may be on the way out because Jetstar and V Australia have both been granted capacity to fly to Fiji. So neither of them have been given as many seats as they wanted. But once they start competing on those routes, Grant, it's going to make it very hard for a tiny carrier like Air Pacific.
That's correct. And it's a very interesting situation. Virgin Australia decided, hey, we've got a 777 here that we're not using when we're not flying to the US. So let's use it over to Fiji. We already have Pacific Blue flying there. We'll swap Pacific Blue for Virgin Australia's 777s. And they've bid for quite a number of seats. They went for over 1,200 seats. They got 900. They got about three quarters of what they bid for. And they caught Qantas napping. The Jetstar group, of which Qantas is a member, if we look at how things are going with Jetstar's taking over from Qantas. So the Jetstar group, they suddenly discovered that, oh my God, somebody's competing with us on this link, because Qantas is actually a 49% shareholder, I believe it is, or 46% shareholder in Air Pacific. And they got quite a shock when V Australia decided to bid for more seats. So suddenly Jetstar bids, and Jetstar only got about half the number of seats they wanted. I think the people allocating the seats took into account the fact that Qantas is a code share and shareholder in Air Pacific. But if you look at the political situation, where Australia is requesting that Fiji be kicked out of the Commonwealth because the current Fijian military government have refused to hold democratic elections before 2014. So Australia is saying they're not a democracy, they shouldn't be part of the Commonwealth, kick them out. So there's a lot of political stuff going on. Now, all of a sudden, you've got V Australia and Jetstar both taking over a number of seats and competing against Air Pacific. There's a lot of people all around the world, a lot of people in Air Pacific, who are now starting to get very, very worried here, and it could very well be the end of Air Pacific. They've been in a lot of trouble since the military took over in Fiji, and we're starting to count the days.
Yeah, Grant, and let's not forget one other thing. We've been hearing rumours lately that Qantas is looking to perhaps divest itself of its interest in the Fijian carrier. Now, really, if that happens, that really will be curtains for them, in my opinion.
Definitely, because they've had a very sheltered life. It was pretty much one 747 per day was what was going on between Fiji and Sydney. Now, all of a sudden, there's all this competition. It's not going to be that walk in the park that they've always had. And who knows what the future holds for the flying fruit tingle.
Yep. And, of course, Fiji is a rather large tourist market from this part of the world. And I have many happy memories from the couple of weeks that I spent over there a few years ago. And, Grant, speaking of happy memories, I think I'll just savour the memories we had today flying around in that DC-3. Mate, what an experience. If any of you ever get an opportunity to fly in one of these classic aircraft, take it. I've been looking at the one we flew on today. I've been looking at that at many air shows since I was a kid. Never thought I'd get a ride on it, and
Wow, what a fantastic thrill.
Yeah, it's been a pretty good day today, and of course I had an extra couple of days up my sleeve. I flew to from Melbourne to Albury on Friday and back via Wangaratta on Saturday. We were reenacting the famous flight of the Iver, a DC-2 that had to do a forced landing at Albury, and very, very interesting history that the Dutch people would love, because the Iver was a KLM DC-2. So Steve and David and Baz are very up on this story.
And as they say, if you're not Dutch, you're not much. However, we're not here to do a Holland report. We're here to do an Australia Dish report, folks. I'm Steve Bisher. I'll talk to you again next week.
And I'm Grant McCarran. And if I can find a new way to get you jealous, I will do it.
I'm sure you will. Cheers, guys.
Well, that was brilliant.
That was fantastic.
I know. Have any of you guys flown on a DC-3? I have not.
I have.
Really?
They were still using them in regular service when I was a kid. So,
so all three of you have flown on a DC-3?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, mine was an R4D, but yeah.
Close enough.
Sorry, Max.
Yeah, I'm going to have to correct that. I tell you, I'm also a sucker for engine noises, and I thought that was just fantastic. So we'd like to thank Steve Vischer and Grant McCarran for another great report from Down Under. If you want to hear more from those guys, you can catch them on their own podcast. That's the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, which you can find at www.planecrazydownunder.com.
I heard they have a great historian.
Yeah, I think that's you, isn't it?
Nah, really?
Yeah.
David, are you double dipping?
I'm code sharing. You know that.
Code sharing. Okay.
Okay. We have another great Whiskey Tango Foxtrot from Courtney. This is actually based on an idea that came in from a listener. We received an email from Richard. Not Branson, who had an idea for Courtney's Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, which we pass along to him. And here's what came back.
Fasten your seatbelt by inserting the metal fitting into the buckle and adjust the strap so that it fits low and tight around your hips. Release the buckle.
Again,
let's
turn on the seatbelt sign.
Hello, everybody. This is Courtney back with the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot for this week. Normally, it's a bit difficult for me to find the stories that we use for Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, but lucky for me and unlucky for four pilots out there, it was not difficult this week. Thank you, Delta Airlines. And I also want to thank the user submission because this was suggested to us. So if you have a suggestion for a Whiskey Tango Foxtrot moment throughout the week, send it to the geeks at airplanegeeks.com. This from CNN, FAA probes planes landing in Atlanta. Apparently, Delta Flight 60 from Rio de Janeiro into Atlanta was cleared to land about 6:05 Monday morning on runway 27 right, but landed instead on taxiway Mike. Taxiway Mike runs parallel to the runway. You may ask, why did they land on Mike? Well, the taxiway and the runway are both just as long and parallel and only a couple hundred feet apart from each other. Blue lights equals don't land. White lights equals land. Those are the runways. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot Delta. But not to be outdone, the Northwest pilot group must have been upset by the amount of publicity that the Delta pilots were getting, and they said, you missed the runway by a couple hundred feet? Psh, we can miss it by 150 miles. This from the Wall Street Journal. Pilots of Northwest Flight 188 became distracted in conversation while cruising at 37,000 feet Wednesday night, didn't realize how long their plane had been out of radio contact, and flew about 150 miles past their airport destination, which was Minneapolis. They were coming from San Diego. 150 miles past. No radio communication during that time. In fact, there had been, I think, several hours that they hadn't had radio communication. There were security issues. The FAA had notified the military. Airplanes did not leave the ground, but this was a big deal. Apparently, they just became engrossed in conversation. The pilots were set to tell federal investigators on Sunday that they lost track of time and location, I'd say, but never went to sleep. And they failed to respond to air traffic controllers for more than an hour, according to people familiar with the crew's statements and the status of the probe. So, with these two stories this week, the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot actually goes out to somebody completely different. And I'm sending out my Whiskey Tango Foxtrot this week to Richard Branson. What? What does Richard Branson have to do with all this? Richard Branson has missed the first opportunity at publicity ever. If Delta lands a couple hundred feet short, and Northwest misses the airport by 150 miles, only Richard Branson can say, psh, 150 miles, we can miss the entire planet with Virgin Galactic. So Richard Branson, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Oh, great. Thank you, Courtney.
Oh, my God. You know what? None of us get out enough. I think that's really the problem.
I know.
If Court needs ideas for this, he should just contact me. I do this every Friday at aviationweek.com. It's called Strange But True Aviation News.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point.
You may become our next best source.
Please. I'm happy to share.
But hey, be careful. I wrote a letter once saying that you really need to add this as a thing and look at what they got me doing once a week. Be careful what you say here. Yeah.
Rob, I think you had some top 10 reasons why the crew might have missed the radio calls.
Oh, you know, I did post something up on Jetwine tonight, which is Sunday as we're recording this, and I called it the top 10 reasons they missed Minneapolis. So it's kind of cool. Did you want me to read them?
It's up to you. We can.
I don't mind. I mean, I don't. I think I own the rights to me, so I can
go ahead.
Talk about me as much as I want. And from what Binet said,
no one's going to stop you.
I've been doing very well at it lately.
That's great.
So, you know, hey, listen. Some people get 15 minutes of fame. I had maybe 18. So this is kind of cool.
Okay. Go for it.
Top 10 reasons why they missed Minneapolis. And by the way, I want to be real clear. The only reason that we're even poking a little fun at these two buffoons is that nobody got hurt. I mean, I'm sorry. I call them buffoons because I was a pilot for a long time. I still am. And I just think this is just ridiculous. But okay, number 10, they were texting. Number 9, it had something to do with sex. Number 8, each pilot thought the airplane knew the way since Airbus aircraft are all automated anyway. Number 7, they really did just fall asleep.
Yeah.
Number 6, they couldn't decide who should have the Nintendo Wii next. Number 5, it had something to do with sex or money.
Yeah, there you go.
Number 4, it had something to do with sex and money.
Even better.
Number 3, they were trying to understand Northwest's new slogan, "We'll get you within 150 miles of there." Number 2, the pilots actually have no idea at all why they weren't paying attention.
Oh, wow.
And the number one reason why the Northwest crew missed landing at Minneapolis, they were abducted by aliens, but returned an hour later because even the little green men couldn't stand to listen to these two guys whine about the company anymore.
Very good, Rob.
Excellent.
All right. Well, we should start to wrap up. We did get some listener email and one voicemail.
Unless, of course, they said something bad about me, then just cut me off now.
If I'd had that material, we would have started the show with that.
All right.
Just quickly, some of the email. This came in to the Airplane Geeks website. My favorite part is the WTF. The guy who does that bit is just dreamy. Great job on the outtakes this week. Poor Dan gets picked on when he's not around. But that's what happens when you choose school ahead of the Airplane Geeks. Lessons learned. That came in from somebody called Miller22.
Ooh. Okay, so who you might think recognize. That was a lady or a man?
I think that's Courtney.
Oh, oh, right. Oh, duh. Oh, jeez. Oh, my Lord.
Okay.
Rob, you need to get out more.
I need to get out yeah. more. I really do.
Jet Bob writes in that a Continental Express plane landed at his tiny home airport after weather at two other airports forced it to divert to KLAM. And provides a link to that. That's always exciting when you have a commercial flight land at an airport that never sees commercial flights. We also got an email from Peter, and you can read. I won't read the whole thing because it's a little bit long. But you can read this on the site. It says he recently discovered your podcast and thought you might be interested in this. He represents the Eastern Airlines Flight 401 Tribute Group. This is a group of crash survivors and families who were touched by the December 29th. 1971 crash of Eastern Airlines Flight 401 near Miami. This was the first crash of a jumbo jet, which killed 101 people. As you're probably aware, this crash gave birth to CRM training, something that is, again, very much in the news, given this week's U.S. Airport overshoot. And he's got some links to several websites that are devoted to the crash and efforts to erect a memorial on the crash site. So you can take a look at that. And then we also received a voicemail from John.
Hey, guys. This is John Harbin from Monett, Missouri, a corporate pilot with a banking software company. Listen to your podcast every week. Wanted to say great show and hello to whoever happens to be hosting this week. I have a question for you for Stephen Grant. Often in the U.S. we say going south with a negative connotation. I wonder what they say on the Australia desk. Thanks. Bye.
Well, it turns out that we can answer that question.
Well, hey, Grant, did you hear that, mate? Somebody on the Geeks podcast has asked Little Odd Us a question.
Will wonders never cease?
Well, John, to answer your question, we had to give this quite some thought through the day because you probably want us to say things are going north. But in fact, we probably just say they're going south, mate.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much it. We say, oh, mate, things are going south. Things are going really south, mate. And that's really saying something because when you're at the south of Australia, there's not much more south than Tasmania.
Antarctica.
And other big empty spaces of nothing.
Yep, down the tubes, down the gurgler. What else can we say? It's cacted, mate.
Oh, it's cactus. It's not looking cactus. Good, mate.
Yeah, it's cactus.
Oh, it's got the raw prawn, mate.
Cactus stuffed us.
Yeah. Mate, it's on the slippery slopes, man. It's sliding its way down. It's out of here.
Yeah, John, we can probably think of a few other ones that probably aren't fit for broadcast. But no, going south, that's a universal one, mate. The connotation meaning going down, I guess. So
yeah,
there you go.
Doesn't matter which hemisphere you're in, south is always at the bottom of the map. So when your profits are going south, everyone knows that means to the bottom.
Yep, that's right.
Oh, it doesn't say much for us, does it? Hang on. That means we're at the bottom. Oh, bugger.
Anyway, John, I hope that answers your question, mate. Cheers.
All right. Well, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, we can't guarantee you'll get such a complete and an extravagant answer, but you can always try.
Okay, kids, give us a call at 361-GEEKS01 with your comments, questions, and observations.
Fantastic. I'd like to thank Binay Wilson from Aviation Week. Thanks, Binay. Always a pleasure to have you. We should have you more often.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
And we also had John Ostrower from Flight Global and Randy Padfield from Aviation International News. We'd like to thank them for joining us this week, making time in their busy schedules. David, also, as always, thanks for providing the This Week in Aviation segment.
Thank you, guys.
And also thanks to Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron for the Australia Desk report. All right, time for the plugs. Binay, where can people find you online?
You can follow me on Twitter. I'm AvWeekBinay. And you can also follow our blog, which is aviationweek.com/biz.
Terrific. And David, how do people follow you and get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter at DMVanderhoof. Or you can see my blog at whatjustflewby.blogspot.com.
And Rob Mark, I'm reluctant to ask because because you've gotten so many plugs so far in this episode.
God,
but once again,
it's my It's my 18 minutes of fame. It's really nice to have had so many nice comments from so many people in the industry. I really, really appreciate it. I mean that quite seriously. I know it sounds like I'm making fun, but I'm really not. You can find me on Twitter at JetWine, JETWHINE, or you can find us at JetWine.com, where we seem to hang out all the time. Scott Spangler and I hang out there. So
fantastic. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com, also on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to follow the Airplane Geeks on Twitter. And you can visit us at our website, which is airplanegeeks.com. Leave a comment, sign up for the newsletter. Send us email if you'd like. That address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we love voicemail. Leave us a voicemail, and Binet's going to tell you what number you can call to leave that mail.
Please call us at 361-GEEKS-01. Again, that's 361-GEEKS-01.
Fantastic. All right, opening and closing music is, as always, provided by Brother Love. You can find his work at brotherloverocks.com. And we'd like to ask everybody to spread the word, the Airplane Geeks word. And Rob, how do they do that?
By telling their friends. That's the social media way.
Great. All right. Thanks again to everybody. And we hope to see you next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. Hot as hell.
And finally, also returning, is John Ostrower, the flight blogger from Flight Global. Hi, John. Earth to John, Earth to John.
Okay, we lost John again.
I don't want anybody to have to go through the pain that I went through to learn all this stuff.
It's too late. Randy's already married. Oh, you were talking about something else. Okay. Sorry.
You know, I'm not sure I got a whole lot of outtake material. People have
disappointed.
Now you know why that is, right?
We didn't make fun of Dan.
Well, it's not just that; it's the fact that Dan wasn't here. No, yeah. I'm just kidding. No, we miss Dan. But you know what? How many radio shows can say one of the hosts can't be here because he has to be in his room doing his homework?
I know that doesn't happen very often, does it?
No, it doesn't. So
well, we miss Dan.
We miss Dan, right, David?
We really miss Dan.
We love Dan. Get back to work, kiddo.
That's right.
Yeah, we miss you, Dan. Sorry, he can't hear us anyway, so.